All right, back with you here on the Dave Elswick Show. Let me read just a tad from an article today, a newspaper article that came out today. Over in Britain during these recent attacks, big story, a 33-year-old doorman known as Ozzy led a brave charge against the maniacs in this attack after seeing them repeatedly knifing a woman. Ozzy used bar stools and bottles and whatnot to throw at the attackers, and they finally backed off to do their thing. Permission to possess or to purchase or acquire a firearm, this is over in Britain, will be granted to an individual who is assessed by the licensing authority, the police, as not posing a threat to public safety and having a good reason to own the firearm. Organizations such as target shooting clubs, museums, and firearms dealers must also apply for licenses if they wish to possess or use firearms. Persons who have been sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 3 years or more cannot possess a firearm or ammunition, including antique firearms, at any time. One of the bobbies or police officers during this attack was seriously injured in the attack at London Bridge, being hailed for his outstanding bravery, and I'll go along with that, because he was armed only just with a baton, and the unarmed officer ran right into one of the attackers and suffered stabbing injuries to his head, his face, and leg. And what can I tell you? Even their cops don't have guns. And John Lott joins us. And John knows more about guns in his little finger than I do, and the laws than I do in my entire body. I admitted that in the last half hour. And I like having John on because he can speak truth to stupidity. But I don't know how much truth you can speak over in Britain, John. I mean, have you studied Britain at all? I mean, this is crazy stuff that your cops don't even have guns.
Right. Well, it's good to talk to you again. Yeah. Well, some cops have guns. You have less than 20% of the police officers in Britain carry. You know, but as you say, this guy, this one officer armed only with a baton, was able to delay and hopefully save some lives by using his baton to take on three men who were armed with long blades. But he shouldn't have to do that. And the problem is, I mean, we've seen in France, we've seen in Belgium, we've seen in Germany and other places, attacks that have occurred by people who have guns that are completely outlawed in those countries. I mean, you can't even legally own a semi-automatic gun in France, and yet the terrorists have engaged in attacks there with automatic weapons, with machine guns there. You know, it's when you pass these types of bans, what you often end up having happen is that it's only the bad guys who have the weapons there. And often what happens when police are there is not what we saw with this one heroic police officer running in. The police in Britain often run away from the criminals when an attack occurs because they don't have any weapons that are capable of defending themselves.
So maybe, I don't know if you know or not, I mean, what is the history of this? I guess this goes back, was it that school that was attacked in Britain? Is that when they really cranked down on guns?
Well, Britain didn't have any gun control laws prior to 1920. The original gun control laws that they had weren't based on concerns about crime or anything like that. What had happened was you just had the revolution in Russia, where the Bolsheviks had come into power. And you had a lot of unemployed soldiers in the UK. You had World War I had ended. People were having a hard time getting jobs. There was a recession. And the concern was is that these unemployed former soldiers would go and take up arms against the government and that they would have a revolution in the UK. And so their notion was the first gun control laws was essentially to make it very costly for lower income or even many middle income individuals to be able to have guns for protection or anything else. And the next big gun control laws you had were in 56, and then you had in 1997, after the Dumb Blaine shooting that you're talking about, you had a ban on handguns. So, but what we've seen in each of those cases is violent crime rates went up. You know, you go back before the law was passed, the first laws were passed in 1920. It's mind-boggling how few crimes there were in the UK, even though gun ownership was very common. You know, you go pick up newspapers like the London Sunday Times or other newspapers from that era, and you'll find advertisements in there for everything from walking cane guns to book guns to briefcase guns, where they actually would disguise a gun in a briefcase. So you could just point the briefcase at somebody and fire. And yet, despite regular guns and all these types of specialty guns there being very common, there was virtually no gun crime. You know, you find years. There's an excellent book by Joyce Lee Malcolm, Harvard University Press, Guns and Violence. She's a historian and looks at over 1,000 years of British history using records from the Church of England there, which had remarkably detailed records on deaths and births there, to show that you have a place like London, a city of over 8.5 million people. There'd be years that there'd be 2 gun murders. There would be years where there would be 5 armed robberies. I can't even get my head around how you can have gun ownership very common and have 2 gun murders in such a large city as that. So there was something else there that was different about the place that's completely irrelevant to gun issues. And as I say, the original impetus for gun control had nothing to do with concerns about crime.
Yeah, so, John, do you hear any difference in thoughts over coming across the pond now with the recent attacks that have been occurring? Are there outcries about people being able to have self-defense capabilities in the streets and things of that nature?
No, not really. I mean, there's been a little bit in France, but it's been more with regard to when police could be armed. So one thing that most people don't know is that in 2015, November 2015, when they had the concert hall attack there,
right,
which killed most of the people, I can't remember, I think it was something like 90 people died in just the concert hall attack. There were 8 off-duty police officers who were actually present in the audience during that attack. But at the time, police off-duty were banned from being able to go and carry guns with them.
Amazing.
I mean, one can only imagine how that massacre there might have turned out differently if even some of the police officers had been able to carry guns. Since then, last June, France has started allowing police to carry guns with them off duty. So, I mean, there's been some slight change. But look, you and I both understand that, the odds that a police officer, whether he's on duty or off duty, is going to be present when one of these attacks occur is fairly slim. One of the responses, both after the attacks in France and after these attacks in England, had been to simply put more police or more military on the street. After the Charlie Hebdo attack, the president of France put 10,000 troops on the streets in Paris. But look, at any one time, that basically means 2,500 or maybe 3,000 because they're not all on the street at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But in a city of 2.5 million people, you simply can't go and cover all the possible targets. Having somebody in uniform guarding a place, it's like putting a neon sign above the person saying, shoot me first. In the Charlie Hebdo attack, the first person killed was the police officer who was stationed there to go and guard the newspaper. And whether it be the Orlando attack here in the United States or the attack on January 1st in Istanbul in Turkey, or time after time in the United States or other places, the people that you have in uniform are the first people shot at. Anybody who's read my research knows that I think police are extremely important, the single most important factor for reducing crime. But to have police or military in uniform trying to guard possible terrorist targets, I mean, it's an impossible job to ask them to do. I mean, it's heroic for them to be in those types of places, and we can be thankful they try. But terrorists have huge strategic advantages in determining the time and place for attack. If you have those guards there, they can kill them, they can wait for them to leave, or they can simply pick some other area where you don't have guards there. And that's what we see happening time after time.
Yeah, here we have them come across the bridge driving a truck, and they got the guys with knives in the truck, and they jump out, and then some got some other guys with knives in some other areas. I mean, they attacked three different areas at once.
Right. Well, look, you know, the number of police that you have in any country is just a tiny percentage of the overall population. In the United States, we have over 600,000 police officers. But when you consider the fact that, you know, we're a country of 320 million people, it's simply, you know, you could have three times the number of police. And again, not everybody's on duty every minute of the day. You know, you could have four or five times the number of police, and there's no way that they could possibly guard all the targets. One of the benefits of concealed carry is not only can you cover a lot more targets, but you also make it safer for those police in uniform, because if the terrorists know that there may be civilians there with guns, when they want to go and attack the officer in uniform, they must realize that they're leaving themselves vulnerable, that they're letting other people know that they're there, to go and do an attack. And it could be somebody behind them or the side or in front that they don't know is armed, that will see their position and be able to go and respond when they pull out their gun to go and shoot the police officer.
Well, I got to ask you, John, are you ever invited over into London to speak? And when you speak, does the press show up and ask, how did you get these crazy ideas?
Well, I actually gave a talk at Cambridge University in January of this year, but no, the press wasn't there. I've done media for the BBC a number of times, but they're really derisive. They just find it incredible. In fact, I've had a couple interviews where the interview's just been cut short because I don't think the producer kind of fully informed the host there exactly what I was going to be saying, and they just found it too unbelievable.
All right, you got time to take a call with us?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
All right, let's go to Rick. Rick is joining us here on the Dave Elswick Show. Hey, Rick, how are you? Your question for John Lott.
Good, Dave. My question is, it's my understanding that France now is looking at banning large kitchen knives. Have you heard anything about that?
I mean, surely Britain has had discussions about that, banning knives that are longer than a certain length. You know, but it's kind of ridiculous type of argument, as I'm sure you're implying, and that is, you know, it's very easy for people to go and make those types of weapons. You know, it's not really obvious what you accomplish by trying to do something like that. I mean, here we have terrorists who are able to go and get machine guns in the country, even when semi-automatic weapons are banned. And the notion that somehow they can't put together a longer knife or something themselves just isn't very serious. I mean, I wish it was that simple, that you could simply go and ban these particular weapons. You know, it's kind of like in the United States where we talk about trying to ban large-capacity magazines. Most people don't realize, I guess, that a magazine is just a box with a spring in it. I mean, somebody with very simple machine tools can go and make a magazine. And obviously today, with things like 3D printers, you don't even need to have that. So it's, you know, the notion that somehow you can ban magazines or you can ban, you know, knives longer than a certain length just aren't really serious discussions, I don't think.
Anything else that you have for us? Nope. He got his answer, John. You did a good job. We've got a couple other people calling in. If they're wanting questions, we'll get them to you if we have time. Bottom line question is that it seems to me that the people in Britain and at least the law enforcement and the politicians and those all across Europe just have a propensity to downplay self-defense for their average citizen. Is that the way you read it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not universal. You have the Czech Republic, which is fairly similar to the United States in many ways. They have over about 2% of the adult population has a concealed carry permit in the Czech Republic, and I think it's increasing. You've had moves in places like Poland, discussions to change the rigid laws that they have there, some of them, many of them that date back to the communist era. So you've had debate. I went and gave a talk in January in Brussels, and I spoke to members of the Polish parliament in January also. And people were beginning to consider these types of things. You know, one very dramatic statement a couple of years ago came from Ron Noble, who was Secretary General for Interpol, kind of Europe's version of the FBI. And he had been Secretary General for 15 years. When he first got there, he was a strong gun control advocate. But what he said he had learned was that there are two ways to make places safe. Either one, just ban guns, or two, make it so that victims can defend themselves. And he, as I say, he started off with the first view, but what he began to learn was that it's really impossible for soft targets to make them gun-free zones. These killers, these terrorists, plan these attacks 6 months, a year, 2 years in advance. And, you know, with that much planning, whether it's a movie theater or a mall or a restaurant or what have you, they're going to figure out some way of getting weapons into that facility. And all you've done then is make it so that the victims can't go and defend themselves. You make it easier for those killers to go and pick those types of targets. And, you know, that's to have somebody based in Europe of his position, I think maybe that's one reason why he was no longer Secretary General, but to even have somebody like that who's thought so deep and hard about these issues raising those points, I think, you know, shows that the debate is going on, that people are beginning to think about this. You know, Israel. When Israel first got founded, civilians weren't carrying around guns. They had the same approach that France or England's had when they've had attacks to put more police, more military on the street. But they eventually realized that they didn't have an infinite amount of money, that no matter how much money they spent, terrorists who were patient could wait until the police had left the area and then go and do the attack, or they could find some place that wasn't guarded. And eventually Israel realized that they had to let civilians have guns with them in public to be able to protect themselves and others. And I don't think they're ever going to go back on that.
Yeah, I don't either. And it's a sad situation, to be honest, and it's a sad situation for the populace, but the populace has been taught for a long time now that they really don't need to be walking around with a handgun in the small of their back or whatever and concealed. And that would be to train them would take some time as well to make an effect. And going back to what you said about terrorists, I mean, who would have thought terrorists would have used planes, and they used planes. And everybody said, now we'll take care of the planes so they can't use them. And what do they use now? They use trucks. They use cars. They use things that we use every day, and they use it against us. And that's just the way it is. And then we solidify our defenses to check everybody coming into a concert. But if you set off a big pop or you wait until everybody's leaving the venue, somebody's standing outside with a vest on, and they blow themselves up and they kill people.
I mean, that's exactly right. So here they have this concert in the UK over the weekend, and people have to spend hours getting into the facilities there. But as you say, you have to come out someplace. People are going to be coming out in mass at some place there, and so they place the bombs, as they did the first time there in Manchester, where the exits were. So, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to guard the outside of all the exits, and then what do you do for that? I mean, all you've done is pushed out the perimeter.
That's correct.
And so they can go and push out where they plant the bombs. And it's just, you know, it just doesn't seem like they've kind of thought these things through. I mean, it'd be nice if there were these simple solutions that were there, but, you know, it's a lot of cost and not obviously much of any benefit.
John, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for giving us the extra time today, and you have a great week, and we will talk to you in the future.
Thanks. People can find more on this at our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org.
All right, we'll make sure we get that on all of our social media as well. Thank you very much, John. We'll talk to you later. Of course, John Lott. I've had John Lott on my show for well over a decade, and when you want somebody who knows the information, he is the one.